This is Gary Hazen. I'm interviewing Joe Gilligan at 6360 Brown Road in Mesa, Arizona on June 4th, 2000 at 12:45 p.m. Can you please say your years of service and what rank you were when you retired?
My years of service were, I put about approximately 21 years active duty. And I retired in November 1980. I retired as a lieutenant colonel, yes.
And when were you in Vietnam?
I was in Vietnam from July 1969 to July 1970.
And the units you served in Vietnam?
Well, I served in the 8th Military Police Group, Criminal Investigations. I served 6 months when I initially got there as the Adjutant S1 at the headquarters in Long Bend. And then for the last 6 months of my tour, I served as the Detachment D Commander in Saigon.
When you found out you were going to Vietnam, you were a career military officer at the time.
That's
what
correct.
What was your thinking, your feeling? How would you feel about going there?
Well, I guess I had mixed emotions on what I did. I didn't like the idea of leaving my family for a year, but at the same time, I was excited because I was a career officer. I felt very strong about our involvement in Vietnam, and I felt it was my obligation to serve there. And so I had mixed feelings, excitement, anticipation at the same time, some regret to leave my family.
When you arrived in Vietnam, what was your first impression of the country and the people?
When I arrived, initially I didn't have a heck of a lot of contact with the people. I was picked up at Benoit, if I remember, flying in, and then whisked away to the 18th MP Brigade headquarters, because being a military police officer, they had friends there that knew I was coming, and they brought me in there, and so the first few days and weeks were there while I got my assignment as the adjutant. So my impressions of the country were, of course, it was hot and sweat and humid, and I didn't see much in the Vietnamese initially.
Now, as the S1 of a CID, or a criminal investigations battalion, you were mainly responsible for personnel.
Personnel and supply, yes. And that's what I did for a lot of, handled that aspect of it, and went out to some of the units throughout the country to see what their needs were in the personnel side and supply side and that type of thing. So I had the opportunity to go to a few other places like Vung Tau and Quy Nhon, and actually went to Cu Chi several times.
And that's a normal position that a career officer will hold throughout their career as an S1, as a staff officer, correct?
Well, that's in the progression. It's not everyone would be able to do that, but that would be a normal for that at that time in my career, yes.
And what was your living conditions like when you were as part of the battalion staff?
Well, in the group staff there, I was in Long Bend, which is kind of a built-up area. Our hooches were not a Quonset hut, but similar to a Quonset hut type thing. And I had a room with a bathroom in it, and it was a little complex with other officers of similar rank there in Long Bend, close to our headquarters.
So as a field grade officer, you were a major at the time. So
I was a major.
You had a fairly good living conditions.
I have to say, yes. It was austere, but and certainly the latrines were not portable potties, but they were the old wooden one holder, so to speak. And so that aspect was rather Spartan, but as in comparison to people in the field, I had it rather good, if I can say that.
Now, when you visited the outlying troops, did you experience any interaction with the Vietnamese people or Viet Cong?
As a matter of fact, they did, especially in the Cu Chi area. And you're making me think of things. Things are coming back to me a little bit. I recall going into the town of Cu Chi itself. A little story about that.
Mm-hmm.
And walking along the streets, there were sidewalks were wooden planks. I mean, the old Wild West, when you see the movies. And I can recall walking, people that I had met there had brought me in to see, showed me the area. I can recall walking along that street, coming to the corner, and seeing three dead Viet Cong laying in the gutter right there at the corner, which shocked the dickens out of me. And that the, and I asked about it, and they said that they had been shot the previous night in the area, and that the Arvin soldiers had put them there as a warning to the people not to give any assistance to them or to the Viet Cong or something, or this could, fate could be, maybe, you know, they could suffer the same type of fate, which was, I don't want to say shocking to me, which was surprising to me, is I watched the children, women, everything walk down the street. When they got to where the bodies were, they simply sidestepped around them like they were sidestepping a puddle or something. There was no shock or surprise at anything. It was like ho-hum, daily routine type thing. It didn't seem to bother the Vietnamese as much as it bothered me to see them lying in the street. They were used to it, the scene, I guess, on almost a regular basis. It got to that point. It got to be ho-hum, daily, you know, what's new.
As the S1, you were responsible for personnel. So,
another story about Kuchim.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. You know, it made me think of that too. At the same time, after doing that, after doing that, they decided to write out and show me some of the perimeters where some of the soldiers were and Arvins were, and we rode out on the road out quite a ways from the main camp there. And next thing I know, I did hear gunfire. And there was a couple squads of Vietnamese soldiers in front of us, and one was shot and killed right in the road there, not maybe 1,500 yards before in front of us. And we were in a quarter-ton jeep. There was three of us, full colonel and two majors. One of the majors was driving. He was with the division, the 25th Infantry Division. He was driving. He was showing us the area. And the three of us got out of the vehicle and got down behind the quarter ton. And I was carrying a Smith Wesson 38 with six rounds in a 2-inch barrel. And that was the weapon. That's all we had amongst the three of us. And we hoped that the Arvin would take care of whatever they had to take care of. And they did. They gave it all clear in about 5 or 10 minutes later. But that was my sole exposure to any kind of combat, to be very truthful.
That was your brush with combat.
That was my brush with combat. I saw a soldier get shot and killed, a Vietnamese soldier shot and killed, and I was a little concerned about if a group came down the road, because all I had was the 38 with me.
Since you watched the South Vietnamese Army operate 50 feet in front of you, what was your evaluation, or how did you feel they were able to fight and protect you, I guess, and two other officers?
Well, that few minutes there, where, of course, they seemed to be doing the right thing. I watched the way they deployed and the orders they were given, and they seemed to the best of my knowledge, to do what I thought was right and cover the area and deploy themselves correctly. So I got a good impression at that time, and, of course, to be very truthful, I was very happy that they were able to secure the area and declare it clear for us.
As the S1, you're responsible for all personnel. Did you have any casualties or any losses of American soldiers while you were the adjutant of the group?
No, we did not. We really, we were very fortunate. We didn't have anything like that happen to us.
The main mission of the group was
That was to provide. Of course, the mission of the military police is to ensure good order and discipline. We were responsible for investigating felonies involving U.S. Army soldiers or Department of Army civilians, and that was what the 8th MP group criminal investigation was to do, and that was the main mission of the CID in Vietnam.
You mentioned briefly your 38 Smith & Wesson. Mm-hmm. That was the weapon that you were issued in Vietnam?
That was the weapon I was issued, that's correct. And all the CID agents were issued either the 5-inch or the 2-inch Smith Wesson, the agents were. And, of course, we had other weapons. We had clerical personnel and supply personnel and other soldiers assigned to us. And they, in most cases, probably had rifles. AR, what was 15 at the time, I guess.
Well, I'm assuming that the 38, and I know that usually the 38 was issued for those who were working undercover. It's because it's easily concealable. Usually they'd use the 45. Mm-hmm. Was the CID agents in country, were they wearing civilian clothes, or were they actually in military uniform performing duties as...
That's interesting. We had some wear civilian clothes, and in the Saigon area, we had some in civilian clothes because they participated with other agencies and stuff like that, and they wound up wearing civilian clothes. They did special assignments and special investigations, but otherwise, the agents wore the normal fatigue uniform that we all wore, the field uniform.
So the CID agents actually had an office and just investigated, even just like they were part of the military. They didn't actually attempt to do covert operations or undercover operations.
The Detachment A in Saigon, I was Detachment D, which did the normal things. Detachment A was a special action operation, and they probably did get involved in some covert things that I wasn't exposed to. When I was in Saigon, the commanding officer, I was commanding officer of Detachment D, I'm getting off again from the adjutant, but the commanding officer of Detachment A was a guy named Flip Fair, CR. His nickname was Flip Fair, and he had done the My Lai investigation previous to that assignment. And so he had, after doing that, he stayed in Vietnam and took over that detachment for about 6 months doing other special investigations in the Saigon area.
Well, we can get on to the Saigon because it's probably the more interesting part of the year there in Vietnam. That's very interesting about the other commanding officer. Did he tell you anything about the My Lai investigation, or did he talk about it at all?
Yeah, he did a little bit, and I'm trying to recall some of it. If I recall rightly, actually, he had some photos to show me at one time, and did talk about it, and... not to a great extent. At that time, a lot of that wasn't public knowledge, but it happened, and unfortunately, it was a black eye for the Army, but it certainly wasn't something that the Army could be proud of in that situation. It was a terrible thing, and it happened, and Lieutenant Calley was involved in that, and apparently... as you read about it, this is all true. People were killed unnecessarily, and civilians and women and children. It was just a terrible thing.
As the commander of Detachment D, what was the main mission? Did you have road patrol? Did you actually send patrols out? Or did
No. We provide CID support for the Saigon area, and we were investigating people that were involved in black marketing and... drug dealings and other aspects of other crimes, you might want to call it, or felonies or things of that nature. There was a lot of black marketing going on, and people were making money. Unfortunately, some of the soldiers fell into that, whatever greed or whatever caused them to do that.
What was the size of your detachment, and what was it comprised of?
In Detachment D was, I had about 15 criminal investigators, and most of them were warrant officers, and I had a couple enlisted investigators, and I had some clerical people, soldiers. I had a supply sergeant. I had some civilians that were interpreters and did some clerical work for us, too. I had an unusual... we were in the Cholon district of Saigon. That's the Chinese district. Our building where we... our detachment was in a three-story building that had, prior to the war, the hostilities, had been owned by two doctors, a husband and wife, who were physicians, and used that as a clinic, and actually treated people there, and in some cases housed patients there. It was, as I said, three floors, and I don't recall how many rooms it was, eight, nine, ten rooms. well, maybe more than that, maybe 12 or so rooms or so. And had an inner courtyard inside, and we had a roof set up where we set up a recreation area on the roof, place like a bar where we could have beverages and chairs and tables we could sit around and read or eat or things of that nature. So we converted to our own needs, and that was our quarters. We had a kiosk out front with I can't remember what the name we called those soldiers, those conscripts we had, where they sat with shotguns. We had one right in front of the door. So if his job was to make sure no one came in or came up the walkway that didn't look like they were authorized, especially Vietnamese, and also not to let anybody stop on the street in front of our place. There was no parking. There was no loitering. And he would... We had them there 24 hours a day, and his job was to make sure no one would come near the building that he didn't think was authorized. And periodically during the day, we would hear gunshots, because what they did was, if someone stopped or loitered or pulled up, he would order them to move, and if they didn't, he'd fire a round over their heads, and they would move.
Was that an American soldier?
No, I'm sorry. These are more Chinese. They were conscripts. I forget what they were... employed, true, was working with the U.S. Army, but that's what they had this little kiosk, like a little, you know what I'm talking
guard
about.
Box.
Guard box, shack, that thing. And we were all fortified with the sandbags and things like that. But that was his job, and we had the one 24 hours a day. And then we had automatic weapons in this arms room and stuff. I mean, besides the 38 the people carried, we had rifles and machine guns and that type of thing, and we were... we had an action plan in case we came under any kind of attack or any kind of hostilities there in Saigon. And we did that when the Tet Offensive, I was there the year after the original Tet Offensive, I guess it was 68, or 69, 70, whatever. But, or 70, 69, I remember. But anyway, we were there the year later, and we had a plan if that happened again. And I had a staff sergeant who had been former infantry, and we signed him to the weapons and to figure out what to do on the rooftop and things of that nature. And I recall when the Tet came around, the anniversary in 70, we were there. That morning we heard some explosions, and we set the plan into action and all flew up onto the roof and locked all the doors and had machine guns and rifles and pistols, and the whole group was up there. And it turned out to be someone had thrown a hand grenade not too far away from us. From a vehicle, but there was fortunately no second Tet Offensive that year. But we were prepared.
Did you billet there as well, or just the troops, just your men?
Oh, we all stayed there. I had an individual room with a tile bath. I have to tell you, it was like a clinic. It was like a little hospital. In fact, all the rooms were that way. They were all tile floors, and each had an individual bath with it.
So
it was an unusual assignment, to tell you the truth.
CID does live better than the other half.
And we had all sorts of, quarter tons, we had a bunch of vehicles assigned to us, I don't remember the number at the time. And we parked them, we had a parking area directly in front of the building, a little bit to the side, where we chained them up, chained the steering wheels and parked them there at night. And the guy in the kiosk would kind of keep his eye on them. We had it lighted and stuff like that.
So how did you run normal operations? Did you have an agent on duty? Or?
Well, we had of course there was always a guy on duty, and then we had a CW3, a chief warrant officer three, that was an operations officer. And he would make the assignments and that type of thing. And I handled the administrative side and went around coordinating with other agencies and stuff like that in Saigon.
So you had the entire area of Saigon?
For the United States Army, yes.
And
some parts north of Saigon. It was a big area.
Do you remember any? What was your special emphasis, or how did it work? Did the group commander tell you, Major Gilligan, concentrate on drug interdiction, concentrate on black market, or did it work like that?
Yeah, he did. I mean, we had some priorities, but And that's exactly, those are the areas exactly we did get involved in. So there was, I don't recall anyone's particular priority. That things just happened. They were reported to us. They reported to military police, referred to us, and we looked into it further. So it was busy operation all day long. There was, but those were the areas we did look into. Black marketing, there was a lot of drug dealings going on and stuff like that, unfortunately.
How did the military police actually refer these cases to you, to come on a blotter and you have to get it that way, or how did it work?
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, yeah, through the provost marshals, and there was a provost marshal area, there was an MP battalion in that area. Yes, we got it through. The 716th MP battalion was there. They provided military police support. Did a heck of a job, and the year before they got really involved in the Tet Offensive. They did a lot of infantry-type stuff and distinguished themselves quite well the previous year. From me getting there.
Do you remember if as a commander of the detachment you would be in charge of discipline for any of your warrant officers and your enlisted
yes,
troops?
Yes, of course.
Did you have any discipline problems during your 6 months there?
I don't recall any discipline problems at all. It was an unusual situation, I guess. We were all, although that was a built-up area in a very cosmopolitan city, despite being in a war zone, whatever you want to call it, people worked together as a team. They looked out for each other. We were concerned with our safety, even though we were in a big city. We rode around in quarter tons, and we carried. We used to take. We all carried. I carried a 2-inch Smith & Wesson in the small of my back and a little pistol, a little holster. The driver, when we got in the vehicle, we always talked about if someone threw a grenade in the vehicle, which was common. People would drive up to a vehicle and throw a grenade in there. So we said if someone threw a grenade in, which way will you go, and I'll go, you know, you'll go to the right, and I go to the left, so we figure out how to jump out of the vehicles. So we always kept a rifle in the back seat. We carried weapons on us. We were always cognizant of who was around us. When you pull around in the streets and stuff, I mean, the traffic was horrendous, and cars and bicycles and pedicabs and trucks and everything would be right on top of you, and people could easily just throw something in or fire on you or something like that. So we were always cognizant of that. We looked out for each other. We were concerned about our well-being. I mean, we didn't want to get hurt or hurt anyone else, too. But
was your vehicles identified as CID or military police?
Well, no. You know, that's just funny you used to say that. I don't recall if we had... I think we probably did have an 8th MP group on the... The more I think about it, on the bumpers. Well, we had some civilian vehicles too. We had a couple of Toyotas too, which sometimes people rode in. We had actually leased. We had two Toyotas leased.
Well, not only did you have to worry about the Vietnamese and Viet Cong, but not too many American soldiers liked CID or MPs as well. So you had to be cognizant of pretty much everybody besides your little inner group.
Of course.
Did you have to investigate the fratricides or any of the investigations that dealt with the soldiers besides the drugs and the black markets?
Well, I never got involved in it. There were cases the 8th MP group did investigate that I was aware of. There was one in the 173rd Airborne where we had an NCO that was shooting civilians. And it turned out finally that they realized what he was doing and investigated it. I can tell you a little bit of the story. What he would do was go out on patrols with people and go off by himself somewhere and wind up shooting civilians. This is the digest of it. He would shoot indiscriminately people and then check them out, and if they weren't Viet Cong, he had carried in his pack and stuff some Viet Cong clothing and artifacts and weapons and stuff, and he would drop them there at the area and then call the squad or his platoon sergeant or platoon leader rather and say he had shot these Viet Cong, and they'd come over and see the black pajamas or the weapons and say, "Good job, Joe," or whatever his name was. And after his second extension or something there, like he was on a second year there or something, and he was always doing this, people got concerned that something's screwy here and they want to get the CID involved, and it turned out that's exactly what he was doing. He was shooting people. He had gone apparently mentally unstable after a while and that kind of stuff. If I remember, he was 173rd Airborne.
But that stuff was mainly more on the field rather than in Saigon.
No, yeah, I just recall that was one of the agents from up in that area in some sort of liaison meeting and mentioned this story, saying it was kind of a wild story. Unfortunately, that did happen.
What was your impression of the city of Saigon?
The city of Saigon, I liked it. There was bustling and a lot of markets, and they had some good restaurants, that type thing. And that I went to some French restaurants. It was somewhat surreal at times to be in Saigon, to be very truthful. I didn't realize it's a war zone and people were being shot at and terrorist acts were going on. I mean, but the city seemed to not even be cognizant of that. I mean, I went to church in the Immaculate Conception Cathedral down by the palace on the Royal Palace, the palace they had there. DM was in the palace. Well, he wasn't at the time I was, but the palace. I used to go to church there and on Sunday Mass, a couple hundred Vietnamese there, people. Same thing seems to be a normalcy to the city. I mean, there were, and at the same time, I can recall going to eat somewhere by myself, driving a quarter ton on a Saturday night, and coming back to my quarters, and going through the market area, which I was always bustling and a lot of activity, and looking around and realizing there was no activity. and there was nobody on the streets, and I'm riding down the street saying, "What the heck is this?" And then all of a sudden I hear loud noises and firing, and then I could smell tear gas, and I realized something was going on, and I made a decision: should I go back where I came from, or should I continue on, which was probably about a quarter of a mile to my hooch, and I put a handkerchief around my neck and floored that sucker and drove up to the Cholon area. And the tear gas got very strong, and I could hear a lot of shouting and activity, and pulled up in front of my place and ran in the building, went up to the rooftop where all my people were, and there was some rioting going on, and the Vietnamese soldiers and police were handling some sort of disturbance about the war or whatever they were doing, and they were throwing tear gas, and for many blocks there was no activity, and people were back in their homes, closed the shops down and stuff. But so that was unusual, but that kind of stuff happened periodically. But otherwise, the city seemed to be just like any other big city. You wouldn't know that you were in a combat zone. You wouldn't realize that when you rode around. Except you saw armed soldiers walking around the street, but the city was just clipping along. And this is 69, this is 70 now when I was there.
This kind of brings up a good point. As you said, you went out to dinner. What was your normal day like? I mean, did you have a set 8 to 5 and then free time, or how did that work? As commander?
Well, as a commander, yes, I would get. We got in the morning. We did. Well, 8 to 5. We worked. Sometimes we worked long hours. We didn't really punch the clock, so to speak. You got up in the morning and you worked till when you thought, whatever it was, 5, 6. If you had to stay and do something, you'd continue to do it. If you had a special project, you worked 12 hours. If you didn't, you worked 8 hours. That was what I would do was do my paperwork, talk to people, go over cases, have meetings, go to lunch, dinner. we got friendly with a local school there in the Chinese district, which was very close to our compound. One of the soldiers, one of my people, somehow got to meet someone and volunteer that we would help them out with, so many assistance we could. We wound up playing basketball with them, probably a couple blocks from our place in Saigon. And they actually had a basketball team in our high school. They had some big young men in there that were learning the game, and we used to go down there with the 6, 7, 8 of us, including myself, and play them maybe once or twice a week basketball at night in a courtyard. We had to go through a big gate, and they locked it all up, and we all got inside there, and they had a basketball court set up. And what did you do, Daddy, in the war? Some nights I played basketball at 6, 7 o'clock with some big tall Vietnamese guys. And they sometimes did pretty good. We probably maybe won 2 out of 3 games or so. But that was what I did for recreation, to tell you the truth. Well, during the lunch hour, I might go up on the roof and and do some exercises and stuff like that. We didn't really have an exercise program in the, as a normal unit would have, a military unit would have. Or we used to sit in the sun maybe during lunch hour and read.
So your free time would, you know, go up to the roof or go out to eat or go play basketball, huh?
That's about it.
Did you feel safe when you would go out to eat by yourself?
I always did. Of course, I was younger then. I was in my 30s and I was invincible, I thought. And I wasn't worried about getting hurt, but I was cautious. Yeah.
You were cautious, but I mean, did you...
I wasn't worried about it, no. I have to tell you, I wasn't. I know that sounds funny. I mean, I was rolling down the street, as I said before, I'd be careful where I was, who I was next-gen driving and stuff like that. But I wasn't real concerned.
When you left Vietnam, or left for Vietnam, you had a wife and kids, I'm assuming, at the time?
I had a wife and two daughters, yes.
And how did you, how was the communication back and forth, and how did you feel about leaving them, and how did that work, the home front?
How did it work? Well, here's what we did. When I got my orders to Vietnam, I checked into a little bit. We had to figure out where where at the time I was living in the Washington, D.C. area. We had to figure out where the family was going to live, and at that time I read of something where it says you could relocate to Hawaii if you wanted to be. Prior to that, you could only go to Hawaii, your family could only go to Hawaii if you were in fact a permanent resident, that was your home, basic home and stuff like that. So I checked that out and found out that the Army was now permitting the people to relocate the family to Hawaii if that's what they chose to do. And I chose to do that, and we went and moved my family to Pearl City, Hawaii, and right outside of Pearl Harbor. My wife and two daughters. We got a small condominium type place, they lived there for a year, and that allowed me the opportunity. When I took my R&R, I went over there. In July, I guess it was, I took my R&R at the holidays around the Christmas and stuff, and that allowed me to fly to Honolulu, which was part of one of the R&R sites, and spend my Christmas holidays with my family. And at the 8-month mark, they allowed you another R&R, and you weren't guaranteed where you could go. They would give a space available for you, and my commanding officer allowed me to go on R&R after the 8th month in Vietnam, and I put myself on a waiting list to go to Honolulu, and fortunately, after being only there a couple hours, I was got on a flight to Honolulu. So I went up at the 4-month mark, being away from my family, going to see them, and then at the 8-month mark, going to see them for a week, which broke up the tour nicely as far as I was concerned, and it was good for them too, for us to see each other.
So that was probably pretty much an anomaly, and most of the people didn't get to visit their family.
Well, my experience in what I saw with the average soldier and officer, even average army type, was they would get an R&R. They would do one. Obviously, they weren't living in Hawaii, so they would have their loved one or perhaps the whole family, or spouse or whatever they chose, meet them in Honolulu. And I mean, Honolulu was jumping at that time with people doing R&R, but most people weren't living there, as I was. I would say the average soldier got one shot to go to on R&R and usually took it in Honolulu. There was people that were single and didn't have families or ties, and they would go to, you were allowed to go to Australia, and you could go to Thailand, you could go to Hong Kong, and people opt for those, too. And in some cases, even met significant others there too, but Honolulu was the biggest on our site when I was
After your year in Vietnam, you when you came back, what did you, how did you think and feel about your experiences in Vietnam when you were leaving?
Well, I was happy to leave because I felt that I'd done my year there. But how did I feel about it? I was glad to serve there. I felt it was, as a career officer, a career soldier, that it was necessary to do that. At the time, I felt we were right in being there and providing the assistance to the Vietnamese. And I was glad I did what I did, and I did the best of my ability, and I was proud of myself.
Have those feelings changed at all?
No, my feelings haven't changed. Not at all. I still feel, I was glad to have served there.
I have some regrets about the number of Americans who are lost there and civilians and things like that. And I said this later on, and I wrote some notes there. I thought our goals were lofty and what we wanted to do, but I'm not so sure that losing 57, almost 58,000 soldiers or military was worth what we achieved.
When you returned to the United States, I'm assuming you flew to Honolulu and got...
I flew to Honolulu and met my family, which was wonderful. And of course, Hawaii and Honolulu, that area was really a military area. They were, the economy thrived on the military, and there were so many Army and Navy in that area. I mean, people were very supportive of the military, and so my experience going back there, the neighbors and people and everything welcomed us and glad to see us, and it was nice to do that. And I went from there to Kansas.
So your next duty station was in Kansas.
I went to Communal Staff College after that, yes.
Did you have any experiences of people that were anti-war?
No, I never experienced that. And I was glad that that didn't happen to me. The people I knew and the people I met immediately after Vietnam didn't act that way at all.
Now, before you even left Vietnam, was the war unpopular, and you realized that before you even went, or did it become more unpopular while the year you were in Vietnam?
No, I think the war was unpopular before I went, and I think as time went on, it became more and more unpopular. But it was an unpopular war, and I could understand why it was. There was some reservations as to why we got in it in the first place with the Gulf of Tonkin, and at the time, Vietnam was in chaos, and President Johnson decided to use his powers that the Congress had devoted them in, was it August 64, where they said if you thought there was any threats to naval vessels or something, you could bring in forces to repel those threats, and Johnson used that. He really did an undeclared war. And there was some controversy over whether that was justified in doing that. We went from, 16,000 troops or something there then in 64 to, by 70 or 69, 70, there was 500,000 troops there. And, it was unpopular because Johnson's theory was to bomb the heck out of Vietnam and that the communist people and North Vietnamese stuff would buckle down to the bombings and stuff. But they didn't. They did.
Would you say that when you got, we talked earlier about when you went to Vietnam, was it pretty much fait accompli for you? You're a military officer, you know that sooner or later somebody's going to say, okay, Major Gilligan, you're going to Vietnam, or was it just...
Yeah. Oh, no, I knew that was in the offing because there was such a turnaround. Some of the infantry officers were going there. They may come back for a year and then maybe come back for 2 years and then go back again. I mean, I knew some infantry officers that went in a period of about 8 years, went three times. So 7, 8 years, went three times. That was a lot. That was a lot to ask of them. But I, as a career person, I actually welcomed the opportunity to do that, and I felt I should do that, and we did. But I'm glad I didn't have to do more than 1 year. I have to be truthful there.
You alluded earlier to a question I'm going to ask now. How do you think the goals of the U.S. in Vietnam, was it justification for what happened? Or?
No. Well, the cost of the war, I mentioned 57,000 Americans died. I don't know how many civilians got killed. But I mean, I'm not sure the losses that happened justified that. Our participation. I mean, that's all hindsight.
What do you feel about the anti? What? How do you feel about the demonstrators? Like the President Carter pardoned all the draft dodgers. The people who like Jane Fonda. How did you feel about those then and now?
Well, that's funny. I didn't have any problem with Carter pardoning those people. I guess there was some closure and bring the people back, things like that. At the time, I thought the demonstrators were wrong. But that was their right to demonstrate, and I saw nothing wrong with that. I felt they were perhaps ill-informed and not supportive of our country and our constitution and president and stuff. Jane Fonda, I had mixed emotions about her. I think she's and still do think she's a little unbalanced in her thought process and suffers from poor judgment and things of that nature. But no, I didn't have any animosity toward any of those people. I was disappointed perhaps in some of them, but I don't have any. I don't bear any animosity toward them. That was their right to do that.
You mentioned earlier going to Mass in Saigon. Do you think the religious fervor of the soldiers increased while they were in Saigon? Did you see a more of a turnout on Sundays than you think you would have seen if you'd not been in?
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. I never thought about that. I don't think so. I went to the cathedral where a lot of the people then were mostly Vietnamese, but then I went to some services where I was a Catholic and I went to where the priest did it. And it was somewhat different because all the soldiers would be there and he'd say, there used to be one priest and he'd say, do you all want to go to confession? And everybody raised their hand and he'd just simply say, I absolve you, and he wouldn't listen to confessions. He'd just say, think in your mind what you want to tell me, and he'd give us absolution right then, and to send you right out. And, I think the soldiers maybe have a little more religion. It's just like, I'm sure they had a lot of religion, and the atheist has religion in the foxhole type thing, and I'm sure they all do. But I would think maybe that'd be the case, because you found people were away from their families and loved ones in their country, and I felt sometimes going to church and sitting and thinking about things and appreciating what you did have in your own in the United States was nice to do. You had some solace and you could think. And I think maybe people, the more I think about it, maybe you're right, Gary. The religion helped them along to put in their time for the year.
Did your attendance increase, or was it pretty much the same before and after?
Oh no, my attendance. Oh no. No, I still go to church. I just came from church now before this interview. I'm born and raised with the nuns in St. Joseph, and I learned to go to church every Sunday no matter what. And I've followed that over the years since. Hopefully it's done me good.
What do you take away from Vietnam? What did you learn that you can apply in your career afterwards and even now that you're retired and in another career?
What did I learn from Vietnam? Well, I mean, I learned. I have to tell you that I certainly have an appreciation for the United States and our way of life and everything. I mean, what I saw in Vietnam was, well, of course, a lot of it was autocratic and the way they ran the country and stuff. And then the generals overthrew Diem and they didn't do so well. And a lot of corruption. Perhaps some of our politicians are somewhat askance in their doing. But I thought the civilian leadership and what I saw in Vietnam was lacking. I thought there was a lot of corruption. I thought the country was ill-run. And what I took away from that is I got appreciation for our way of life and our political system and our liberties, which I didn't see in that area.
And it's along the same lines, but how did it affect your life? Or did it affect your life?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it didn't have a big impact on my life. I didn't suffer anything or suffer any losses either from family or friends. I was fortunate that way. It was a learning experience for me, and being away from the family was not the best thing. Did it affect me? No, I wouldn't say. I took it in stride as an assignment and a learning experience. And as I said, it gave me appreciation for the things that we do have here in the United States. So that's what I took away from it.
That's pretty much all I have, if you'd like to add anything.
I don't have anything to add. That was an unusual era. People who lived through it have a lot of unusual memories, I'm sure, with the protesters and things that the presidents and Nixon did and things like that. But I don't have anything really to add. It was exciting times, unusual times. I'm glad they're all behind us, and I hope we've all learned something from it.